Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with The Reason Podcast. Today, we're talking with Catherine Mangu Ward. She, of course, is the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine. And we're also talking with Andrew Heaton. He is a stand-up comic, a web personality, and an author. Check out his Facebook videos at his Facebook site, Mostly Weekly, and also his great book, Laughter is Better Than Communism, which is available at his website, mightyheaton.com, as well as Amazon. Thanks, guys, for joining me.
Thank you.
So we had the final debate, the final of three, you know, and I think this might have reversed the curse of three. You know, The Matrix 3 was terrible. The Godfather 3 was terrible. Ghostbusters 3 is so terrible they won't even make it. But this, I thought, was the most interesting or informative debate. A lot of the early chatter right out of the gate, even before the debate was over, was about how awful it was. And terrifying and Putin-esque and puppet-esque and, you know, just god-awful that Trump refused to proactively concede the election before it was over, or the legitimacy of the election. Catherine, what did you think about that moment? Is it a big deal, or is this just kind of, you know, the media looking for something to talk about?
You know, when everybody gets in the mood to do hand-wringing about Trump, I do have a little contrarian impulse to stick up for the guy, which, you know, makes me doubt my own internal moral compass. But, you know, Trump is not the first person to subtly or not so subtly imply that the election has been rigged against him. And on some level, it's like, yeah, don't concede that the election was fair before the election actually happened. On another level, though, it's the United States in 2016. The election is fair. And yeah, it's ridiculous to pretend otherwise.
Yeah. And well, do you think it reveals, you know, some of this is about the temperament and that that's part of what gets exposed in these kinds of rough and tumble debate situations? You know, is Trump's temperament, whatever that means, you know, is he unsuited to be president?
I think it's much more about his vanity. I think he has this notion of himself as a shrewd negotiator who keeps all his options open. And I think that's what's happening here. He's like, well, you know, a guy who gets good deals wouldn't foreclose the possibility of renegotiating the deal after the fact.
Right.
And it's like, well, maybe that's true. But like, also, that's like a real douchey move to renegotiate a deal after the fact. If you agree to the terms, you got to abide by the outcome. And I think that's one thing we've seen from Trump is that's kind of not his MO. He's like, oh, maybe I won't pay this invoice. Maybe I won't honor this contract. Like, let me see if I can get an angle. And that's what's happening here, too.
Andrew, what do you think? Yeah,
I'm going to respectfully disagree with Catherine. I think that preemptively refusing to admit defeat is not a good sign and is already undermining the democratic process. And aside from just sowing seeds of doubt with everybody, I think it's a particularly bad time now because Trump brought in a lot of people that are usually not a part of the political process. And from what I can tell, they're kind of going through this moment where they showed up to pro wrestling thinking it was real. And now they're experiencing the dissonance that comes from finding out that it's, you know, it's kind of pre-written. And in a sense, it is, you know, the debate commission controls who shows up. It is stacked. But to imply that the whole thing is rigged and that there's some kind of conspiracy and the election's been stolen out, I think that is going to undermine the mandate to govern from whoever wins. And so it's a very irresponsible thing for him to do. It is in keeping with a lot of the things he's been doing, like threatening Hillary with jail time and, you know.
Well, you know, he said he would appoint a special prosecutor. If I can stick up for Heartland Rubes, Andrew, that you were just slagging as professional wrestling fans who mistake it for something other than spectacle. And I want to point out, Andrew, you are from Oklahoma originally. Is that right?
That's true. I am descended from pro wrestling fans and monster truck rally people.
Yeah. So, I mean, you have standing then to, you know, write off the majority, the silent majority of America. But I don't think it's that big a deal. And what bothers me about it is, you know, and I'm not voting for Trump. I don't like Trump. I think his policies are god awful. But the outrage that you get in these types of moments just and Catherine, I think this pushes me into the kind of unthinking contrarianism that you actually pulled yourself out of. But, you know, I was, you know, in 2004, a ton of people were talking, you know, Democrats were saying, oh, that Bush stole the election via Diebold voting machines in Ohio. You know, people were well into, I was doing various TV shows with people like Katrina VandenHeuvel of The Nation, who was still correcting people when we said we elected Bush. No, we selected Bush, or the Supreme Court selected Bush. There's always, you know, gestures towards the illegitimacy of the other candidate's victory. But can I ask, because I think all three of us agree we're libertarians and libertarian leaning, the system is rigged. It's not that, you know, new Black Panther Party members are going to scare you at the voting place, or somebody is writing in the names of dead people in numbers that actually change outcomes. But, you know, where was Gary Johnson last night? Where was Jill Stein, who is also on enough ballots to theoretically win? I mean, is there something to that question and that seemingly broadly felt idea that something is rigged in America, and it may not be the political election per se, but it's the economy, or it's the process, or it's education, or it's whatnot? I mean, Catherine, do you think that you know, that sentiment needs to be kind of openly addressed and either confronted, or we need to change certain things in order to kind of, you know, make people feel like we should invest in the large system we call America?
I think there's a difference between rigged and structured. I mean, you know, there are rules. Those rules are, for the most part, publicly accessible. And we might not like the rules, and we might want to change the rules, and we might think the rules lead to bad outcomes. But I mean, maybe this is just sort of a little too much dictionary.com, yeah. But like, rigged means something else. Rigged means that, mm-hmm. that someone is sort of secretly undermining the rules we agreed to. And unless you're very naive, I don't think that anyone thinks the rules we agreed to are every single human in the United States has an equal shot at the presidency, or third parties are, you know, to be accorded identical respect to the two major parties. Those aren't the rules anyone thinks we're operating under. And so I think the notion of being rigged implies a more underhanded situation than I'm willing to endorse.
Andrew, what about the larger implications of, you know, is there a sense, and you seem to have, you know, a particular insight into the people that you leave behind, your family members and extended family. And I realize, because you're from Oklahoma, that means that some of your extended family members are also, you know, blood relatives as well.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a lot of intermarrying and all of that type of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But
we're very close.
Is there, you know, is it a problem that it's becoming regularized in discourse? And of course, this is not something that Donald Trump has said. It's also what Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders in different contexts talk about, how the economy is rigged, so that if you keep your nose clean and you work hard, you're still going to get, you know, Wells Fargo is still going to take your, you know, take your house and cut your knees off while making you pay your student loans. Is that a concern that has bubbled up in this election that we need to address? And or is it just that people are malcontents and, you know, they're mad because their lives aren't working out and there's really nothing you can do to address it?
Well, I think both of those things are happening. To the you know, extended rodeo clown family that you allude to, when I talk to people in the middle of the country, they are much more pro-Trump than I'd like them to be. But from what I gather, it's not so much that they like Trump. It's not so much that they agree with him, is they just sort of see him as a Molotov cocktail that they can fling at Washington, and they like the idea of shaking things up. I don't think he's the right Molotov cocktail to throw at Washington, but yeah, a lot of the situations coming out of it are stacked against the average person. One of the things that, you know, Trump has used as a businessman that we haven't talked a lot about in this election cycle is eminent domain, where he can come in and use the power of the state to force people out of their homes, and you know, have this sort of unholy alliance between his company and the government to benefit him. And yeah, if you're a normal person, I think it is kind of stacked against you. If your business doesn't have the right contacts, you're not going to get subsidies for it. You're not going to necessarily get tax breaks for it, and so you're not playing on a level playing field.
Do you think in Brooklyn and in other quadrants for hipsters, are there revolutionaries who are now working on artisanal Molotov cocktails, you know, made with the finest ingredients that, you know, that you find perhaps in a you know, in a great gin and tonic at an old place.
They're delicious. Yeah, and they've got these square ice cubes. They're wonderful.
Yeah.
I think that's actually the new Gary Johnson slogan, is the right Molotov cocktail to throw at Washington.
That's actually, you know.
I go for that.
Yeah. Did you miss Gary Johnson at the debate last night, Catherine? And do you think it would have made a substantive difference to have Johnson on stage at any or all of these?
I think having Gary Johnson on the stage might have pushed the conversation more in the policy direction, particularly in the second debate. There's just, it's sort of like, you know, when a married couple is fighting and there's like another couple at the dinner table, they tone it down a little bit. And I think that's how it would have felt, right? Like just this idea of, you know, they're sort of sniping at each other and, well, what about that time you didn't wash the dishes 20 years ago, right? Like that seems to sometimes be the level of the Trump-Hillary bickering. And it just seems like a third party up there might have been like, okay, guys, calm it down. Let's talk about the debt for just like a hot second.
Maybe that's
overly optimistic on my part.
What would have been great would have been if we, you know, instead of this debate format, we should have had, you know, Trump, Hillary, Jill Stein and Gary Johnson do a scripted reading or a dramatic reading of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm channeling.
That's how they select the prime minister in Canada. That would have been good. I wish Gary Johnson had been in there. To my knowledge, have they brought up the drug war at any point in any of the four debates? I mean, I think they kind of touched on it, maybe sort of during the vice presidential death match. But for the most part, what is the biggest underpinning factor to crime in America and, you know, locking people in cages, that a very, very big domestic issue is just not even on the radar. And I think if Gary Johnson had been present, that would have come up. He would have at least shoehorned it into the conversation.
Yeah. And it is fascinating to think about crime. To a certain degree, I mean, Trump has been running explicitly as a law and order candidate and is trying to reinsert crime as a national issue into a presidential debate for the first time really since the 90s. And it really is tied to a lot of drug war policies that also fed the militarization of police and whatnot. Let's talk about a couple of the actual policy issues that came up. Foreign policy, first off. Trump and Hillary both took kind of swings at the pinata of foreign policy. I apologize for metaphors that go nowhere. And actually, given that most pinatas are actually made in China, I apologize for bringing in, for offshoring my metaphors as well. Andrew, do you have a clear sense of what either Trump or Hillary were talking about in terms of foreign policy as it relates to Syria, which each of them, you know, talked about as an unfolding tragedy, but did you get a sense of what they say the U.S. will be doing next or should be doing next?
I think so in the case of Hillary Clinton. I'm a quarter politician on my dad's side, and so I can kind of speak that language, and I could parse out what she was saying, which from what I can tell is basically smarter George W. Bush. The policy that she was outlining was American intervention across the globe is a force for good, and we need to be intervening and making sure that there's not a vacuum and going in and potentially arming Kurds and that kind of thing. The question that she kind of deflected that I thought was a really good one that was brought up was, would you have a no-fly zone in Syria? And if that brought to the brink a shooting war with Russia, what would you do? And she kind of pivoted away and said, you know, we should definitely have a no-fly zone. I would get Russia on board and negotiate, and really didn't talk about that, which is an important question because she is wanting an active military presence and wanting to arm Kurds and things like that. Trump, I thought, was completely incoherent. I could not understand his foreign policy position at all. In previous debates and in previous statements, I sort of articulated this muscular isolationism where we need somehow more nuclear weapons and a bigger military, but we shouldn't use it. But then last night, I think at the same time, he wanted to sort of play the non-interventionist card, but he also wanted to be the sort of virile, square-jawed, stronger candidate against the weakling Democrats. So got into Syria and Iraq and Iran and this very unclear way of how he would do things differently and whether or not he would actually send an occupying force to Mosul or anywhere else. So Yeah, I thought he was incoherent, and I thought Hillary was smart George W. Bush.
What about you, Catherine? Did you learn anything new about what these guys intend to do with the American military?
No, and I think that's partially because these guys do not intend to do anything new with the American military. I mean, the parameters in which the discussion was operating are so narrow. And I think it's easy to forget that sometimes because the candidates seem so different. But ultimately, it was still, you know, we're going to be pretty aggressive abroad. We're going to, you know, maintain all of our bases. We're going to maintain all of our presence in countries where we probably don't belong. The sort of, and this is true in many policy issues, but I think in defense, in this election in particular, there's so little daylight between the candidates in terms of their realm of possibility. And it's true, of course, that they're, you know, they have different philosophies on some level, but I just, you know, again, Gary Johnson on the stage could have said something like, oh, hey, maybe less war, like a lot less war.
Yeah.
And that just simply didn't come up and won't come up and won't come up for another 4 years, maybe eight.
Right. Or it'll be forced upon that conversation will be forced upon us on November 9th when some kind of really, you know, major invasion or something happens in Syria or somewhere else or in Europe. What, you know, one of the knocks on libertarians in general and certainly on Gary Johnson in this in this election cycle is that, you know, we're not serious about foreign policy or our answer to everything is just do less. Is that a, you know, is that a meaningful critique of libertarianism or is it actually, no, you know what, that's part of the problem. I mean, I find that focusing on not even just Syria, but Aleppo, you know, as like, oh, well, what do we have to do? And when Hillary trotted out the image of that boy who was, you know, was on every news site and on in every news broadcast for a couple of days, the kid who was totally covered in ash and was orphaned in Aleppo. It seems to me that that's part of the problem is that we're looking at horrible things happening and then saying, what can we do now to stop it without understanding any role of what comes before and how responding to that in a way of we have to save the, you know, we have to save everybody. We have to save people who are kidnapped by Boko Haram. We have to save Crimea. We have to save the Baltics, you know, et cetera. I mean, that we just end up in an endless cycle of doing the same thing without ever reflecting on how we can get to something different. I mean, is or am I just drinking too much libertarian Kool-Aid, Andrew?
I think you're right on that. I think when you look back at American foreign policy over the last 60 years, we are stupendously bad at picking winners. And we're very good at temporarily getting allies and arming them to the teeth and then getting them to attack us a few years later, which is why in the last debate when Hillary Clinton brought up that she was favorable towards arming the Kurds, I thought, OK, here we go again, because they are great right now. Right now, the Kurds are very good friends with the United States, and there's I don't believe there's actually been a serviceman killed in the Kurdish part of Iraq, and there's lots of very promising things about that part of Iraq. But 20 years from now, we've given them tanks and we've given them missiles and all other number of armaments, and someone either rolls in and takes it from them, or alternately, a new political movement realigns them, and they're fighting against us. We've now bolstered what we're going to be fighting against. And beyond that, yeah, I think the level of blowback that we get from being involved in other countries, oftentimes with short-sighted interventions in mind, generally does not balance out. So I you know, it's kind of pithy, but you don't necessarily need to know the name of every city if you're not planning on dropping bombs on it or shooting planes out of the sky over it. So I think it's a legitimate position. I think with, you know, where you get a little bit more nuanced, and I think Gary Johnson's in this camp, as I understand it, is, you know, whether you're going to have some involvement, whether you're going to maintain your relationships. I think NATO's been a force for good and remains one. But there's a difference between saying we're going to maintain these defensive alliances we have with these other civilizational blocks versus we are going to either unilaterally or multilaterally go in and try and tweak these particular regions to have people we like or people we hate but are useful and have this sort of Rube Goldberg type foreign policy, which to me is a much worse idea.
Is that a slam on Israel, calling it a Rube Goldberg foreign policy? Catherine, talk a little bit about, you know, one thing that Trump said that I actually agreed with was when he said, you know what, NATO, our NATO allies, or, you know, in general, our allies around the world have to spend more on defense. You know, they have to pay more of their own way. Is NATO is something, excuse me, which was created to fight the Cold War, and it served a function. The Cold War no longer exists. Do we need to fundamentally rethink things? I mean, because we still seem to be huffing the fumes of a containment policy and, you know, institutions that were created in order to win the Cold War, which ended years ago. I mean, is he right about that? And does that mean, if he's right about that, that we can never have that conversation until the memory of him goes away?
So I don't actually think Trump has poisoned every policy position that has come out of his mouth. I think many will suffer from this. But yeah, I mean, the basic idea that U.S. foreign policy is sort of larded down with commitments that are perfectly irrelevant to the world that we currently live in, Trump is not the first person to say that. He's not the last person who will say it. At the same time, I think there's this kind of magical thinking that Trump and others indulge in, where they say, okay, well, it's not fair in some kind of abstract sense that the U.S. is paying more than we oughta. So what we're going to do is very loudly and repeatedly say, those guys should really chip in. And, you know, it's the same as if you go out to dinner with your cheapskate friend and you always cover the bill.
Yeah.
Like, they're not going to chip in. Like, if you know, either go somewhere cheaper or stop paying.
But you do get to pick the restaurant, right? So it's, you know,
right,
if you're
paying. Now we're going to per se with and then being like, well, you should probably put in more than $20, Europe.
Yeah.
And Europe's like, oh yeah, make me.
And then Europe brags about how it's Europe then turns around and uses the money that it would spend on that meal and puts it into healthcare, education, and then brags about how awesome their domestic spending is compared to us evil military war hawks. I just to stick it to them a little bit, I'd like to pull back on the NATO budget so they actually have to determine whether or not they want to fund their defense versus their wonderful entitlement programs.
Sure. And that seems like a reasonable approach to me. I don't think Trump saying stuff like that has poisoned that for the future. At the same time, the notion that by saying, okay, you guys got to carry your fair share, but also we want the U.S. defense budget to be bigger and bigger forever and ever, amen.
Yeah.
Like, that's why they're never going to carry their fair share.
Can I ask from not specifically about the debate last night, but from a kind of libertarian perspective? So, you know, you look at countries like Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, which are, you know, have been in history's pincers for centuries now and, you know, have an unprecedented amount of long lasting liberty and self-determination since the end of the Cold War. You know, if Russia or if some other country, you know, at various points within, you know, the past 100 years, it's been Germany or it's been Russia, the Soviet Union, have invaded them, from a libertarian point of view, where we, you know, I believe very much in a kind of internationalist sensibility, not in terms of Wilsonian foreign policy, but that people have a right to, you know, self-determination as a nation, but also as individuals. Is there, you know, is there a proper libertarian response to that? Is it, okay, if you can get out of the country, we'll let you, you know, come to America and live your life? Or is it like, it was nice knowing you, but why would we expend any energy, much less life, you know, to preserve those countries' independence?
I mean,
yes.
I supported the Iraq War in 2002. I mean, I, on those grounds, I essentially looked at the world and said, like, oh, God, yeah, it is really true that these are people suffering under a terrible dictator. Probably with relatively minimal expenditure, we could help them out.
Yeah.
Let's do it, because human liberty is liberty. And you know what? Once again, learn the lesson. Governments are bad at stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the lesson that I think we should all keep in mind every single time we have any conversation about this. Governments are bad at everything they do. And while it is, of course, true that freedom around the world is something that should concern everyone, that, like, mm-hmm. American freedom isn't special and different than, you know, Iraqi freedom, we are going to screw it up. And that's the thing, I think, that certainly I didn't hear from either of the candidates on the stage last night, and that I hardly hear from anyone except libertarians, who then get accused of being the ones who aren't pragmatic.
Right. And it's, I mean, you know, the 21st century has been an object lesson in foreign policy dictated by the United States that has failed at its apparent objectives to the extent that they are spelled out. Let's talk about debt and spending, because this was curious. This debate actually ended with a discussion of, you know, of spending, debt, tax policy. Andrew, did you feel that there was, you know, a useful exchange of ideas in terms of, you know, where Donald Trump wants to take the economy, or rather not the economy, but the government components of spending and tax?
No, I did not think there was a useful exchange of ideas. I thought that when they brought up the moderator brought up the issue of debt, and I think for right now, I think it's, according to him, it was 77% of the GDP. Under Hillary, it would be 86%, and under Trump, it would be 105%. Both of them basically said, my plan will magically overcome those numbers that you just threw out. And they did sort of have this reflexive default on Trump going with trickle down economics, and with Hillary going with what I'm going to call dribble up economics. What I thought was interesting prior to the debate, which I wish had been brought up, was that apparently Hillary Clinton in private, rather than in public, has several good ideas, like opposing the minimum wage and being in favor of, you know, a hemispheric open borders and free trade zone, which is very different than candidate Hillary Clinton. But in terms of actually dealing with the fact that with entitlement spending, we can either cut it, or we can tax more, or we can massively grow the economy beyond the wildest dreams of either candidate. Neither of them engaged with that. Neither of them talked about meaningful entitlement reform in any capacity and asserted that they would keep it exactly the same ad infinitum without adding a penny to the debt.
I love the idea of growing the economy. I think I'll go with that option. That seems to be the best way out of this, to triple or quadruple economic growth so we don't have to worry about anything. Catherine, were you left, you know, confident that whoever takes over is going to be a good steward of your tax dollars?
Oh, that's such a sad question. No, I was not confident about any such thing. In particular, the moment, and this has happened in past debates as well, that really made me cringe is when Trump says, as he frequently does, the GDP is 1%. And I don't know. I mean, he's meaning to say GDP growth is at about 1%, right, which A, is not really true. It's a little bit higher than that. And B, that's not the right way to say it, right? Like, I think that phrasing shows how far he is from understanding even his own incredibly basic talking point on this subject. And yet it is also the only substantive thing that he says about dealing with debt and deficit. All he says is we're going to have growth, but he can't even say a single sentence that accurately describes GDP growth. Yeah. So, yeah, it's a, you know, at the very least, I think when Hillary Clinton says sentences about economic growth, they are coherent, but the policies are equally useless.
Does that lead you to a sense of resignation that, you know, by virtually all indications, and, you know, we're still 20 days or whatever out from the election, but that Hillary is going to win, and that, you know, the kind of conventional wisdom is that Hillary is a known, and I hate to be quoting or misquoting Donald Rumsfeld, but she's a known, she's a bad known known, whereas Trump is a known unknown, I guess, or, you know, that there's a lot of possibility that Trump might be okay, but, you know, there's a real high proportion or possibility that he would be terrible. But so, do you fear a Hillary Clinton presidency less, Catherine, than a Trump presidency, or is that not even really the right way to be looking at the next 4 years?
I do think that the variance for a Trump presidency is probably unacceptably high. It could be a little bit better. It could be spectacularly worse than what we might get from Hillary. That said, I think the odds that we will look back on this discussion later and say, gee, maybe we got a little bit too hysterical about Trump and not hysterical enough about Hillary are very, very high. Yeah. Hillary is such a statist. She is so clearly going to use every single tool at her disposal to expand the regulatory state, to expand the bureaucratic scope of government. And I think that's going to hurt, and we're going to be sorry we underestimated that.
And, you know, one of the things that's interesting in discussions of spending in particular is the amount of spending that is on autopilot, because it is in what's considered mandatory spending. It increases every year without authorization by Congress, and it's around 70% of the federal budget, and it'll grow, which is one of the reasons why the debt that the government owes to the public, which is a subset of the larger national debt, is at 77%, and it's going to grow to 86% under current law, or 85%, and then Hillary will take it up a little bit. Trump would take it up more. Andrew, you know, and with the regulatory state, it's something similar where you put in regulations, and it's hard to pull them back and to change them, and they just kind of get on autopilot. And you know, we've seen with Tesla and Google that self-driving cars, we're not ready for them yet. And we're probably not ready for a self-driving government, because it just keeps, it's like Bitcoin. It keeps spitting out more and more on a predetermined basis almost. Andrew, you had mentioned the WikiLeaks exposures. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, does it bother you that Hillary Clinton seemed to be, in many cases, not all, making absolute sense from a kind of libertarian, small government, laissez-faire perspective when she's talking to bankers who are paying her $250,000 a shot, and then on stage she's singing a very different tune?
I think I speak for all Americans in saying that I was shocked that Hillary Clinton is duplicitous and a politician. I did not see that coming in any capacity. There was no way to infer this from the last 30 years. I think what.
But wait, can I hold you on something with that? I mean, is that the soft bigotry of low expectations that say, you know, politicians are liars? So, you know, they're all liars. And in fact, they're not all liars, you know, and there's also something different, you know, when she was quoting Abraham Lincoln and saying, OK, you know, Abraham Lincoln, you know, he wanted to save the Union, but he was anti-slavery. You know, it wasn't the beginning and end, but like, you know, nobody, the South definitely knew what Abraham Lincoln was about when they seceded. Hillary Clinton saying to bankers in Brazil, I want a hemispheric free trade zone with absolute freedom of movement between goods, services, and people, and then saying, I'm against TPP, and I think NAFTA is bad. That's that's not, you know, she's not, you know, kind of being a tactician there to get to a more open border. So I think one of the things that we have to do as libertarians and as Americans and as members of your extended family, Andrew, we need to... You know, we need to start holding people to basic levels of accountability, that you can't lie like as open, or it's not even lying. You can't be that two-faced and expect to have success at the ballot box. Having said that, I'm sorry, I'm getting off my soapbox and talk a little bit about that, you know, that distance between the public and private. Hillary.
Sure. Well, I think that Hillary is more of a politician than most politicians. She's been doing it for a very long time. She does make a distinction between what she privately believes and what she's publicly espousing, and engages in triangulation to get the vote. I think a good example of this is that Hillary Clinton was against same-sex marriage when she was a senator from New York. And now, were you to listen to her, she's always been a staunch proponent of gay rights. And that's not the case. That seems to be happening in economics as well. I don't think that she is some sort of crypto libertarian, and I don't agree with her on a lot of her economic policy, although I am heartened that she apparently seems to be lying about a lot of things that I on the face really disagree with, and she might be okay on. This is sort of she's Claire Underwood, and she's running against P.T. Barnum. And I don't really know what P.T. Barnum's up to, but I think he's a knee-jerk authoritarian. So I'm more worried about him being the sort of unknown authoritarian versus the technocratic statist person. I don't think either of them are great, but I think the one is a sort of slow break on the economy and a slow strangulation force, as opposed to a guy that might wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and decide to try and throw journalists in jail. Overall, I think that they're both bad on the economy, but I suspect that she'll be better. And then a big portion of the economy as well is immigration, which she is better on. Trump is, they both want to build a wall, but she is much more amenable to it. He's been running on a don't let immigrants into the country platform, which is a large portion of why he would have a higher debt than she would, because he would bottom out a significant portion of the economy by kicking out immigrants.
You know, I'm thinking if Trump had phrased his throw journalists in jail program a little bit differently, given that journalists complain all the time about how all journalists are being fired and don't have any work, he could have turned it into a kind of welfare program where he's creating dorms where people, you know, just give him a computer and a printing press and he'll take care of them, give them three hots and a cot, and they can write all they want. Wow. That is, you know, that went over so poorly that even the crickets aren't chirping. So let me ask then, as a final question, as we wrap up here, we're talking with Andrew Heaton of go to mightyheaton.com. He is a regular feature on the internet and especially at Facebook with Mostly Weekly, great commentary on things that happen, as well as the author of Laughter is Better Than Communism, which is available at his website, mightyheaton.com, as well as Amazon, and with Catherine Mangu Ward, who we know as the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine. Please subscribe, rate, and review Reason podcasts at iTunes. But do we learn anything from these debates? Should we have had more of them? Should we have had less of them? We're done with them for 4 years now. There were no televised debates or national debates before 1960. There wasn't another one from 1960 until 1976. Are they worth doing? How might we improve them, Catherine, so that we get more information or we get more revelation?
I think it depends on who you mean by we. I don't think that anyone on this podcast learned anything because we've all been probably to the detriment of our physical and mental health following this election closely. But I do think that there's something to be said for having a moment shortly before the election where we say, hey, America, meet these jerks. Here they are, just so you know. Generally, as you know, I'm a skeptic about get out the vote efforts. I don't think it's a great idea to take people who thought I probably don't know enough to vote or I don't care enough to vote and tell them to do more voting. But that's going to happen. And I would rather they at least have a passing familiarity with the candidates if they're going to get up there and do it. And they do talk about policy sometimes. There is some substance in there sometimes. So for now, I think there is a somewhat of a legitimate sort of public interest pedagogical justification for the debates. Does not make them any less painful for us WikiLeaks insidery types.
You know, Marshall McLuhan in 1976 in the debate between Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford, then the incumbent, where the machinery broke down, actually, Andrew, and the candidates were stuck standing for about 5 or 6 minutes on a darkened set while they were waiting to get the audio back. It was kind of an incredible moment for all sorts of reasons. But he said, you know, these, and it was a moderator structured debate. He said, this is the dumbest use of television as a medium. And he suggested, among other things, that the candidates debate each other or interview each other. Is there a format that would be more useful than what we got? Or in the end, to pick up on what Catherine was saying, you know, have we gotten enough information to make an informed choice about Trump and Clinton at the very least? And then opening it up to, say, a Jill Stein or a Gary Johnson, partly because they're actually polling nationally, or even an Evan McMullen. But Stein and Johnson are on enough ballots to win the election, theoretically. But certainly Gary Johnson, Matt Welch, our colleague at Reason, editor-at-large, recently wrote a post where Gary Johnson is covering the spread in many states. Do we need more inclusive debates?
Well, absolutely, we should do that. I mean, I think the current regime that we have with the debates is vaguely Putin-esque. In Russia, Vladimir Putin outlawed pretty much every party that would have any type of real threat to his own, I think it's United Russia Party. We're living in a system right now where of the, 360 million Americans, am I near the mark? We're meant to have one of two opinions, which is asinine. That's crazy to think that we can only have one of two opinions between that many people. So having more people on stage is absolutely something we should be doing. And it's something where every election they move the goal, or not every election, but generally every election they move the goalpost just a little bit further to make sure that nobody shakes it up. So that's something that absolutely should happen. And I think is an incredible shame that Johnson and Stein aren't in, and particularly in this election where I thought there was a lot of ground where that could have happened and you could have seen a Ross Perot with an ideological compass show up. In terms of ways we could improve the debate in the future, obviously including more candidates would be wonderful. I would like to have one debate where you could only see the transcript of it. Because I think that would be on the downside, very few people would read it. But for those that did read it, I think that it would have a very different effect on them, because most of the people watching the debate are ultimately looking for cues from whichever candidate they already want to vote for to affirm that they are correct in voting for them. And it's not going to be an exercise in rationally assessing their policies. It's going to be an exercise in cherry picking moments to confirm an emotional decision. And when you look at a transcript, boring though it is, it's much easier to go, oh, that person completely evaded this very forthright question. Again, the downside being that we might sit down and read that transcript, the rest of the country might not. But I think that having one where you just actually have it stacked up in print would be useful.
So you're calling for mandatory reading and mandatory attendance.
Mandatory reading.
Oh, man. No wonder you're not allowed in Oklahoma anymore. We will leave it there. I want to thank Andrew Heaton of themightyheaton.com. He is the proprietor of the great series, Mostly Weekly Online. Check it out at his Facebook page, Google Andrew Heaton. He is also the author of Laughter is Better Than Communism, available at his website as well as Amazon.com. Andrew, thanks for joining Reason.
Thank you.
And I want to thank Catherine Mangu Ward, who is the editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine. Catherine, is there anything that you are dying to tell people about what's coming up in Reason as the issue that lands around the election comes out?
There's a bunch of advice that will be in the issue about how to stockpile bitcoins to live a good life in Venezuela. So just putting that out there.
So it's Venezuela is, forget Canada. We're moving to Venezuela. It's the new
right.
Free State Project is where they could really make a difference there. Well, we'll look for that. I am Nick Gillespie. This has been the Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us there. That helps us get meaningful information to create a better product. It also helps us bump up rankings there to get better exposure to libertarian ideas. That's what we're all about here, trying to bring a libertarian voice to discussions of politics, culture, and ideas. We're also on SoundCloud. You can also go to reason.com/podcast to get an RSS feed. So for Reason Podcast, I'm Nick Gillespie. Thanks so much.